Hello, my name is Toni Smith, and today I'm hosting Writer's Talk, production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, and I'm sitting in for Doug Dangler. Today it is my pleasure and honor to host poet Dr. Patricia Jabe Wesley. She's here doing a number of things on campus, and it's my delight to get to chat with her about her work. Welcome.
Thanks.
Okay, it's good to have you.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
In Columbus, in Ohio State.
Yes, that's right. I wanted to ask you about your work. I see from your blog, and let me just read a little bit of your biography, because I want people to understand who it is that they have the pleasure of hearing today. Dr. Patricia Jabe Wesley and her family moved here in 1991 after surviving 2 years of the Liberian Civil War. Dr. Wesley has recently completed the field research and is currently compiling her research on her project entitled They Tell Their Stories, Liberian Women's Trauma Stories from the Civil War. Her research, which took her to three major cities in the U.S. and to Ghana and Monrovia over the past 4 years, is an audio-video recording of more than 150 diverse stories of rape, torture, and executions of women in the Liberian Civil War. Dr. Wesley currently is an assistant professor of English and creative writing and African literature at the Pennsylvania State University's Altoona campus. She lives in Altoona with her family. Dr. Wesley, tell us, given the subject matter that you write about, how is it that you remain hopeful? Talk to us about your work and what it does for you and what it should do for us, what you hope it would do for us.
As a poet who found herself caught up in a civil war, what I saw by the end of my 2 years in the war was that I was alive. I was living. Mm-hmm. And my children were alive. My husband was alive. And my mother was still alive, including my father and many siblings. But I had also lost countless friends and family people and cousins and schoolmates and hundreds of thousands of my people, of Liberians. So as hopeful as I was, having survived those 2 years, I knew how hopeless it was because that war went on for another 12 years after I survived 2 years. So why should I be hopeful? My poetry may seem hopeful to you, but some people think it's depressing or whatever. The reason I think people should be hopeful and why I'm hopeful is to know that among the few lucky who survived that horrific experience of the most brutal kind of war, the guerrilla warfare of torture and mutilation of people while they're alive, the burying of people alive. And the reason why I think I can still be hopeful is because I have a voice. I'm one of the few who still have a voice to tell the world what happened to our people and to keep their stories alive. I think that, for me, is the hope. I'm not the only one telling these stories. I'm not saying I'm the only one, but I am telling the simple, everyday, not-so-historical stories of ordinary people, children and their mothers, women and their mothers. That's hope for me. Yeah. When I tell the stories, tomorrow somebody will read those stories and will avoid war.
Talk a little bit about your work as an advocate. I see that you travel internationally and talk about the horrors of war. How do you think poetry in particular adds to your ability to advocate?
I think the poet has been misplaced in contemporary times. Mm-hmm. And I was telling my students at Penn State Altoona the other day that before there were philosophers and scientists and all these people, there were poets. Mm-hmm. And poets were the conscience of the society. And poets were the feeling of the society. And they were the philosophers. That's why we read Shakespeare mm-hmm. still. All of those great poets were philosophers, and they were the life of the society. And that's how I saw myself. And I'm from an African culture. And in the African culture, the artist belongs to community. The artist is not of herself or himself. The artist belongs to the people. And that's how I see myself. So I was a poet long before the wars. Even in the war, I was writing. And I see my poetry as a means of healing myself. I use my poetry to find healing from the experience. I'm talking today and smiling. Mm-hmm. When I first came out of the war, I couldn't say hello if you said the war. I broke down. I broke down every time, even in public when I was making a speech. But today I can laugh and smile while talking about these experiences, because having written so long, my writing has sort of brought out all of my pain and dumped it on a page for everybody else to experience and help me share the pain. So this is one way in which my poetry can be useful. But also my poetry can be useful because it is the little skills I have. The skills of being able to convert metaphors to feeling and being able to write a persona poem about a man looking for his family, and to write a poem about child soldiers and put myself in the place of the mother of the children who have been used as child soldiers. All of this, to me, is the way in which my poetry can impact society and the people around the world so that people stop fighting wars, okay? So, yes, I believe that my place as a poet allows the voices of hundreds of thousands of Liberians and other people who were not Liberians, and not only that, other people suffering in other wars to be alive, because I am telling the stories. And the reason I know is because when I see people who went through the war with me or didn't know me, or when people read these poems about the suffering of our people, they always say, thank you very much for telling my story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But you asked a question about my travels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is difficult for a creative writer to become a researcher.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say it because I will sound very unacademic if I say I don't care about research.
I can relate.
I really didn't care about research until I realized that somebody needed to tell the stories of Liberian women, even if the stories were just cross-section of the tens of thousands of women's stories.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that after 10, 12, 14 years of the war, there were history books coming out written by the same men who started the war, waged the war, mm-hmm. and tortured the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They were telling the stories from the eyes of men. And I felt cheated. And I felt that my poetry was doing it, but somebody needed to tell ordinary stories.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you an example of what I mean by ordinary stories. When the war came into my town, it had been waged for 6 months before reaching Monrovia.
Mm-hmm.
That morning of July 2nd, 1990, was the fateful day that the first suburb, Painesville, of Monrovia fell. That morning, there were hundreds of citizens, of parents, of mothers and fathers who said to themselves, I am rushing to town, to the bank, to shut down my account to prepare for the war. Mm-hmm. Children, stay home. I'm running to town to get some food to stock up so when the war comes, we will be able to eat. And when those people arrive in town, the rebels that have been undercover all night took Painesville City. at 10 a.m. And many parents were cut off from their children. Mm-hmm. And they got phone calls like, "Mom, they have just taken over the town. There's strange men with guns, and they're bombing down homes. Our neighbors' houses have exploded. They've just killed a whole bunch of people. They are in the streets. We are running. Mom, goodbye. You may never see us again." People left their little kids, their teenage kids, and could not go back home. And that went on for many families for many years. There were women who were cooking outside, and they would tell you, "I was cooking my food. When the first bomb landed, I just fled in the direction I was." There were people who couldn't go back into a house to retrieve their babies, and the babies were killed. Those stories are not being told by history books. And that's where I come in. I feel that as an ordinary person who lived that war, I needed to go back and revisit those women that I could find who were willing to tell their stories, to just tell their stories on camera, ordinary stories. And I didn't find many women who were able to look in my eyes and say, "I was raped," but I found some who said that on camera. And I thought that was great. You see, so those are the ordinary stories that have been lost or will be lost if we don't capture them. Now, the way my research is, when I'm done with the final project, which will be to put together an anthology of these women's stories told by themselves with their names as authors. That's what I want to happen. And one of the things I told the women in Minnesota when they gave me their stories, these women were brought over to the country because of the war. Many of them had never seen a city, a major city anywhere, but they became refugees in big American cities. And they became people that they were not. They had lost everything. And one woman said to me, "Why should I give you my story? I mean, many people were reluctant to give me that story. Why should I tell you? Why should I relive the horror?" And then I said, in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, somebody will ask your grand and your great-grandchildren, "How come they are in America?" I say, if a book is somewhere in a library with a few of our stories, somebody will pick up that book and say, "Oh, I see how illiterate, non-Westernized Liberian villagers came to live in apartment buildings in Minneapolis, in New York," because that's not a norm of immigration. Poor people didn't immigrate. Rich people are the ones who always immigrate. So these people's stories, this book will serve all kinds of purposes, and that's where I see myself. Okay. As a writer and researcher. Now you can break it up in parts.
Well, that gives me a nice segue into my next question about poetry in general. You said in your blog that some poems stay with you. What makes a poem stay with you, and how have you developed your craft to create these really memorable poems that do, in fact, stay with you?
I believe that a poet feels. The best poet feels. And if the best poet feels, then the best poet passes on the feelings to the people.
But is that easy to do, to pass on feelings through a page?
It is easy if you are a poet.
Okay.
There are poets and there are poets.
Okay.
My students went to some reading recently and they were saying how confused they were, and they were supposed to write a paper about the reading they went to. And so they couldn't, and they said they were all confused. And these are intelligent students. So I wanted to know if they could remember 2-3 lines or titles of the reading. And I was at the reading myself. And these students said, "We don't remember. We don't know." And I believed them because I was there. And I couldn't remember the word I heard. Okay? So I'm not putting anybody down. I'm saying that if you are a poet and you have a calling to write and you hone your talent, And you listen to people. I mean, many people mentored me, many across Americans and Liberians, but mostly in the last 10, 15 years, American poets mentored me. Okay, if people mentored you, and you know that Robert Frost says that every poem is a new metaphor inside, or it is nothing. Robert Frost. Mm. So if you have a poem, and each poem is a new metaphor, it says something about life, the same thing we all know, in a new way, in a fresh way. Those things that poem says will be memorable. And this is what I want to do. I want to be able, I'm not saying I've arrived there. After four books, I don't think I've arrived. But I know that I am seeking to be at a place where when I write a poem and you read it, it will remain with you. Not because it talks about violence, but because of the way it explores language in order to bring that experience to you for you to feel. Because poetry is not about what a scientist thinks. Poetry is about feelings. How human beings, the experiences of our lives, can be brought alive by fresh language. Mm.
You're listening to Writer's Talk on WCRS, Columbus's only community radio station. Writer's Talk is a production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. Our guest is Patricia Jabal Wesley, with guest host Tony Smith. Dr. Jabal Wesley was a recent guest of the Office of Research at The Ohio State University, and we thank Richard Bowers for his help in arranging our interview. For more information about Dr. Patricia Jabal Wesley, see facebook.com/writerstalk. Now, back to our interview.
Let me mention your books. You mentioned that you have four. The River is Rising, Becoming Ebony, Before the Palm Could Bloom, and then your...
The newest one, the title changed.
Okay.
Where the Road Turns.
Okay.
Where the Road Turns. That should come out of Autumn House Press the end of the year.
Okay, good. If you would be so kind as to take a few moments and read us some of your poetry, I think we would really enjoy that.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I think I'll read something old, something new, and nothing borrowed.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. This is what I tell my daughter. It's a poem that was first published before it was first published on the Quarterly Review.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's where we got this from. But it came out in the second book, Becoming Ebony.
And now why did you write this poem?
My eldest daughter, her name is Bise Nyeswa. Bise Nyeswa. Okay. We'll call her Bise for short. Bise is a very intelligent daughter, but she was my first teenager in America. She was a teenager, a normal American teenager. And so she actually took over my writing. I always was worried about her, and I wanted to understand her. She's very complex, like myself. And so I felt a kinship to her also because I had a kind of relationship with my mother, which my mother had with her mother. And so I think she took all my poems. The fourth book does not have a poem about her, and she is very happy about that.
But
this is what I tell my daughter. If my father hadn't scared me, I wouldn't be here. I'd be somewhere down Jala Town or Slipway, where the Mesorado dumps its junk by dark swamps. I'd be carrying buckets full of dirt to turn Morovia swamps into dry land. Or I'd be somebody's wife trying to be somebody's wife. This is how I scare my daughter. You wouldn't be here. You'd be somewhere where babies wait in long lines to be born. Little babies with sore feet, waiting in the unborn world where food can't grow. I would have had 10 children before you were born. You there standing in line waiting to be born while I'd be in some overcrowded town, some unknown city or village with skinny-legged children, mucus noses, bare feet, crying for food. I'd be there, one husband each month, one room each month. On Capitol Bypass, where I grew up, all the boys knew how to get a girl pregnant. All sorts of men and boys, all sorts of people lurking at windows, in doorways, plenty of men from Nigeria, from Sudan, from far away villages in Liberia, from Mars. This is what I tell my daughter. The university bringing the whole globe with horrid feet on our street, emptying its men in one-room boarding houses in our backyard. My father, a barbed wire fence, his needle-poking eyes scaring boys away. The boys call him CIA chief. The girls on Capitol Bypass with their perky brown cheeks, their smooth, pretty skin, their sophisticated steps. My father called them grown-up girls, bringing home sad trophies in teen arms.
I have a teen daughter, so I have a need to scare her too. I love that poem. Okay, what else would you like to read?
Okay, I will read The River is Rising, which is the title poem of the third book, The River is Rising. This time I don't have an exact title out of my book for my fourth book, but I will always write a book and then the publishers will be fighting over titles. And I say, okay, I read a title poem. And that's how this poem came to be. Okay. But this poem was inspired by the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And the end of the Civil War and the election and of the first female president. And you saw her on my blog.
Yeah, yeah, I wanted to ask you about
that.
Yeah. We'll
the first female president and the first and only female president in Africa. And one of the, maybe the one or two presidents in the world. Mm-hmm. And she was elected. And I was kind of emotional about the end of the war, about having a woman president, and about the whole idea. And so it was a bittersweet experience. I was crying and I was angry. I was angry because so many people had died and just for that day to happen. So I wrote this poem, The River is Rising. The river is rising, a song for Liberian women. The river is rising, and this is not a flood. After years of drought, the ground hardened and caked in blood, in dry places, here we are today. River banks are swelling with the incoming tide, coming in from the Atlantic, just beyond the ridge of rolling hills and rocks in Monrovia. Finally, here we stand at the banks. Finally, here we are. See how swiftly the tide rushes in to fill the land with salt. Fish and crabs and the huge clams and shrimps, all the river's creatures are coming in with the tide. The river is rising, but this is not a flood. Do not let your eye wander away from this scene. Yes, all the bones below the Mercerado or the St. Paul or Sino or the Lofa River will be brought up to land so the overwhelming questions can once more overwhelm us. But they are bringing in our lost sister on a high stool. And there she stands waving at those who, in refusing to die, simply refuse to die. This is not a song just for Ellen. This is a song for Mapu and Tene and all the Ellens there are. This is a song for Kema and Musu and Masa. This is for Nyenplu and Nyenwe, for Kou and Glayi and Koto, for the one solitary woman of war. This is a song so Wani will also dance. This is a song for that small girl child who came out just this morning. They are still seeking a name to call her, a river name, a name from the water and from the fire too. That solitary mother in flight will no longer birth her child at the roadside where shells were her baby's first bed. Let the womb quiver, let church bells jingle, let hundreds of drums pound clan clante. Let men bring out old trumpets so the wind will take flight. Let that small pepper bird on a tree branch sing and cry no more the solitary song. Let the mess rattle behind my home, or what was my home, or still is, or maybe, who cares? The river is rising, but this is not a flood.
Really beautiful, powerful words. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about sort of politics in general, because you've mentioned the fact that Liberia has a woman president, which is, I think, a big deal. Mm-hmm. And also because America has its first African-American president. Mm-hmm. And you wrote about it on your blog. What do you think all of this suggests?
And I have a poem called The People Walking in Darkness. Okay. But I don't want to read it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just tell us your thoughts about these two major events.
Well, long before I knew myself, people knew me. They always say I was an independent African woman. I don't know what it meant. To me, I think all women are independent. And because of that independence, I've always believed that the world is very unequal. That most of what we own, what we do, is controlled by men.
Mm-hmm.
And women are always left in the background. And when women want to do things, then people feel threatened because they're women. They shouldn't be doing anything. And so when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf became the first president, to be frank with you, I did not go out cheering her because she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But when she was elected, I thought that was a beautiful thing. I thought it was a beautiful thing because here was one time in our history when a woman could have a page in the history books. Mm-hmm. But like women are always left to do, she is the one picking up the dirt. She is the one collecting the trash that has been created by men.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Liberia is. Now, Barack Obama being African-American, I know he has a lot of similarity with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf because he's now picking up the trash that was left by all of the last administration, you know, and so we are all broke today, you know, because of all the things that happened long before Bush and before, okay, mm-hmm. So they're similar in that way. But Barack Obama's election still brings tears to my eyes. And I am not even African-American historically.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have all of the experiences of the African-American who has worked hard to have me come and enjoy the privilege of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody died for me. Mm-hmm. Every time I think of it, I say, somebody died for you. That's how we say it. Mm-hmm. Somebody died for you. Some people die to pave the road. It's their backs that the cars, the trucks pass on to clear the road. So I will come and pass.
Mm-hmm.
And Barack Obama comes from that similar background. He's a son of not even an immigrant, an international student
mm-hmm.
from Africa. So I thought, what a history to be present in. And I was awed by him,
mm-hmm.
by his personality, by the way he was able to relate to everybody. Because I'm from Africa. I am colorblind. I don't know how to discriminate between my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a party for me, you will have a lot of white people, a lot of Chinese people, a lot of black people, because that's who I am.
For more information about tonight's guest, poet Dr. Patricia Jabal Wesley, see facebook.com/writerstalk. Join us next week at 8 p.m. on Monday for frequent This American Life contributor David Rakoff. Until then, this is Doug Dangler at the Ohio State University Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing saying, keep writing.